Okay, we're beginning here on the bottom of Chaf Amud Bet, four lines from the bottom. The Gemara was discussing a issue with regards to the Mishnah, and the solution to the problem was Amar Yehuda Marav Hamani Rabbi Meir, that the author of this position must be Rabbi Meir, who says that Adam Makdish Davar Shelo Bali Olam, a person can be Makdish something even though it's not yet in existence, it has yet to come to the world. He still has the ability to be makdishit. And then they have the alternate lashon that Amalei Rav Papa Abaye and Rami Bar Chama Rav Chista, that it must be like Rabbi Meir. And the response to them was, well, if it's not Rabbi Meir, who else would it be? It's got to be Rabbi Meir. That was said about the stira that we found here and resolving that stira with regards to our Mishnah. Now the Gemara says, Ve'ika Dematni Lo'aha. That resolution, some people say, was said about this issue, which is a maskir by the chaviro, v'nit naga. Person rents out his house to an individual, and then the house gets nigaim, tzarat abayit. Hapapi shechalto kohen. Even though the kohen has decided that it is now tamei, and they're going to take down the house, they're going to destroy the house. Omer leo, harei shalcha lifanecha. You can say to the renter, it's yours. This is the house you rented. It's too bad. You get what you get, and that's it. Nitit so. If they take it down and they destroy it, then chayav lamid lo bayit. Then he's got to replace the house that was there because now there's no longer a house available that the maskir had promised to this individual. So the Baal Tosafot already notes something interesting over here, which says that it seems to indicate here that if the house has decided that it is tarat abayit and it is tameh and they're going to take it down, that it's mutar to get hana from it. Because otherwise, how can he say, Harei shalcha lefanecha? How can the maskir say to the socher, you got what you got, it's too bad, if he can't get hana from it? If he can't live in there, then he can't utilize it in the way that he was supposed to utilize it. So Tosafot says, from here it sounds like, you could get hana from something that's mukhlat, that's already been decided that it has full-fledged tzorat. The problem is that we find other instances in Shas, especially with Tzarat Bigadim, but also with Tzarat Abayit, that it seems that you are not entitled to get Hana from it. So how do we resolve that stira? So Tosafot says, Zerech Lamar, Deino Chanami, Du Asur Ba'ana. Deino Chanami, here it is Asur Ba'ana. But if Asur Ba'ana, how can he say, Arei Shalcha Lefanecha? V'hadamar Hocha, Domer Alei Shalcha Lefanecha, Hainu Kigon Dam Alei Bayit Zeh. Kevin Dehu Be'en, Inu Chayav Lamid No Bayit Acher. Because he said, this house, Bayit Zeh, and he specified the house that was going to be for the rental, then he doesn't have to replace it. As long as that house is still standing, then he has no obligation to replace it.
And obviously he wouldn't have to pay rent in this situation, but the maskir also does not have to provide a replacement house.
On the other hand, if they take it down, then it's the responsibility of the maskir because the negaim are associated with him and not with the socher.
Since, as Rashi notes over here, the reason that the negaim come in the house is because of the maskir, either because he was a tzarot ayin, gazel. Interesting that Rashi only mentions those two items out of the list that we had earlier in the Masechta with regards to why negaim come about.
And therefore he's got to replace the house, or he's got to put up the house. Although the Gemara in Baba Kama seems to indicate that if he says bayit zeh,
the view of many of the Rishonim in Baba Kama is
that he might not even have to replace the bayit, which would make the second half of the bright a little more difficult.
Nevertheless, Tosafot believes over here, because of the fact that the owner was the cause of the problem of the house being taken down because the Nagim came because of him, therefore he is responsible to replace it in this instance.
That's what the Baal Tosafot will do to solve the problem of how you can get Hana'ah from a house that had Tzarat Abayit. Hiktisho Adarbo, if the person who's living there, meaning the Socher, is Magdishit, Males Karla Hekdesh, then he pays his rental to Hekdesh instead of to the owner of the property. Where it says, Hikdisho Adarbo? How could it be that the person living there is Magdishit? How could the socher, the renter, be the person who gives Magdishit? Heichimatzi Magdishlo. How does he have the right or the capacity to be Magdishit? Ish ki Yagdish Beito Kodesh Amar Rachmana. And from that we learn, Ma Beito Birshuto. Just like his house is in his possession, Av Kol Birshuto. So too, anything that is in his possession. So here the socher does not own the property. The socher is a renter over here, so how does he have the right to be makdish this house? Hachikamar. This is the way to read it. You parsed it incorrectly. You read it as hikdisho adarbo, comma, males skar lehekdesh. That's not the way to read it. The way to read it is hikdisho, comma, adarbo, males skar lehekdesh. So who was the hikdisho? Hikdisho maskir. the landlord was the one who was makdishit. Then Adarbo, the socher that's living there, males kar lektesh. He pays the rental now to Hekdesh instead of to the landlord itself. Where it says, Higdisho maskir, Hechidayerbe. How could it be that after the landlord's makdishit, that the tenant lives there? Bit mi'ila koi. There's a problem of mi'ila, which is misappropriation of Hekdesh, getting hana from Hekdesh. And here, if the maskir was makdishit, then the socher's living there is going to cause a problem because he's now getting hana from Hekdesh, which is not permitted. Vitu. And even on top of that, Males Karl Hekdesh, why is he paying rental to Hekdesh? Came in the Ma'albe, Nafik Le Skar Lukulin. Once he has Mi'ilah, when there is misappropriation of Hekdesh, that takes the item out of the possession of Hekdesh and brings it into Kulin, or it basically profanes the item. So if that's the case, why is he continuing to pay Skar Hekdesh? The way Rashi reads it is that the house is no longer Hekdesh. And therefore, why should he be paying the rental to Hekdesh? The Bali HaTosafot don't love that explanation, because we know in Masechet Mi'ilah, there are different forms of Mi'ilah. There is Mi'ilah on items that are Kedushat HaGuf. Items that have Kedushat HaGuf, if you're Mo'el in them, they're not profaned, and you can be Mo'el in them again. There are also items that have Kedushat Damim. There's a difference between an item whose utility actually uses up the item, versus items whereby when you utilize them, they can be utilized again and again without any problem. So for instance, you have a silver goblet that you drink from. Just because you got hana from it doesn't change anything about the silver goblet, and you can drink from it again and it would be the same thing. So in those cases, we say there is mi'ilah achar mi'ilah, or the item's not profaned. It's only when there's diminution in the item itself where we say that that action of mi'ilah profanes the item. It's no longer chulin. So over here, the house or usage of the house should not then release it from Kodesh, or the Mi'ilah should not therefore make it into Chulin or profane it because you didn't change anything in the house. Now you could argue, like the Gemara in Baba Kamo, by the Sugya of Zenene V'Zelo Choser, that over there we said that if a person lives in the house, he causes blackening of the walls. There is a certain amount of depreciation that happens in the house when a person lives there. There might be, as the Gemara there says, offsetting Hana from it. But maybe if you say it that way, then you can argue that even living in the house causes Mi'ilah that would cause diminution in value depreciation, and then it would become profaned. The way the Bali Tosfot suggested is maybe that's not the case, and therefore the house here, you live in it and continue to live in it, that Hana should produce Mi'ilah, and there should be no profaning of the house. So he says it's a reference to the rental income, that the rental income itself should be the thing that is Mi'ilah, and that Mi'ilah should then profane the rental income itself. So that's what Tosafot says, that the schar is l'chulin. So over here you have two problems. You have one problem, which is, how can the socher live in this property after the maskir was makdishit? There's mi'ilah. And secondarily, even if there is mi'ilah, the mi'ilah in the end will then ruin the object from being hekdesh, turn it into chulin, and then whatever happens afterwards is not going to be ma'les skaro l'hekdesh. You shouldn't be paying the schar to hekdesh. Well, that means that the house is no longer Hekdesh, like Rashi says, and therefore there's no reason to pay rental to Hekdesh. Like Tosafot says, that the monies of the Hekdesh are profaned, and since they are profaned, there's no reason to give that schar to Hekdesh. For both of those reasons, it's difficult to argue that it was the maskir that was makdishit over here. So the Gemara says, Damar l'kishayavo scharo yikdash, that when the rental income reaches my hand, it will be kodesh. So he's not being makdish the house. He's not being makdish the rental. He's being makdish the rental income stream that he's going to get from this house. That he is going to be makdish. Va in adam makdish davar shelo bali olam. Wait a minute. The rental income here is a future revenue source that he's going to get, but it doesn't exist today. So how can he be makdish something that doesn't yet exist in the world? So I'm reviewed on Marav. So this is that statement that we saw before as the answer to yesterday's situation. So here the Gemara says the same thing with regards to this, which is Ika de Matni Naha. But some people say it about this situation. What was the scenario? The scenario was where the maskir was makdish the future income from the property. And how could that be if it's not in existence yet? So the answer is Hamani Rabbi Meir. It's Rabbi Meir who believes Damar Adam makdish Tavar Shalom Bale Olam. Person can be makdish something that is yet to exist in the world, has yet to come into possession of the individual. Iga de Amre, some say Amalei Rav Papa Abaye, Amri Lo Rav Mori Bar Chama Rav Chista, Keman Karabi Meir. Who is that like? It must be like Rabbi Meir, Damar Adam Makdish Davar Shelo Ba'al Olam. Amarlei, so either it's Abaye or Rav Chista responded either to Rav Papa or Rav Mari Bar Chama, Vela, come on. If it's not Rabbi Meir, who else is it going to be? It's got to be Rabbi Meir, because he's the one who has this position of Davar Shelo Ba'al Olam. It's not an impediment to being Makdish, or whether it's to create Kiddushin, all sorts of things, halakhically, where Davar Shelo Ba'al Olam is problematic. Rabbi Meir believes it's not problematic and it's not an impediment. And here too, by Hekdesh, it's not an impediment to him being Makdish, the future rental income, a rental stream that he's getting from the item. The Bali of Tosafot of Yer discuss about this issue of the Socher and the Maskir being Makdish, the property, as to what seemingly is a stira between our Gemara here and the Tosefta, as well as maybe the Yerushalmi. The Tosefta seems to indicate that a Maskir does not have the ability or is not permitted to be Makdish his property. Now, it makes a lot of sense, because why should he have the right to do it? We know that there are two considerations with regards to being Makdish something. One is what the Gemara said before, Beito, Ma Beito Birshuto, has to be in your possession. You must own it in order to be Makdish it. That's what prevents the Socher from being Makdish it. Now then, Gemara says that not only does it have to be in your possession, Baluto, but it has to be within your control. You have to have control over it, not just ownership over it. And that's why Rabbi Yochanan says in the Gemara Baba Kama that a ganav who steals something, neither the ganav nor the balim can be makdish the item. Ganav can't be makdish the item because it might be in his control, it might be in his possession, but he doesn't own it. And the balim can't be makdish it because even though they own it, it's not in their control, it's not in their possession. So you have the same problem over here, which is the maskir owns the property, but it's in possession or in control of the socher. So then it should be that neither the socher, which Argumar agrees, can't be makdishit, nor can the maskir be makdishit, because he doesn't have control or possession over it. So how does he have the right here to be makdish the property, and in essence, hurt the rights or the position of the socher? And so from the Tosefta, it sounds like that the maskir does not have such a right, or does not have that capacity to do such. So how do we reconcile that with our Gemara over here? So Tosafot also brings from the Yerushalmi a view that during the period of time, during the rental period, that the Maskir does not have such a right to be Makdishit, but the Socher does have the right to be Makdishit. And the Socher can be Makdishit up until the point of when his ownership terminates. Now obviously he can't be Makdish the property. What he can't be Makdish is the hana that he's getting from it, and therefore you'd still have to pay the rental to the maskir, but any hana or any benefit would then have to accrue to Hekdesh. And Tosafot then makes such a suggestion with regards to the maskir, which is that maybe the maskir has no right to take away the socher's rights of rental over here, but what he can do is be makdish the excess value that's above the rental value that the socher is entitled to. Then maybe he can dedicate towards Hekdesh, or he can give to Hekdesh. So that might be a way to solve the problem and say that's what's spoken about with regards to the Maskir. It's the amount in excess of what is present here that the Socher's rights are preserved. And then Tosafot in the end comes up with a differentiation which says that it depends on how the Socher's renting. If the Socher prepaid the rent, then the Maskir has no right to injure or to impede on his ability to rent here, and therefore the Maskir can't be Makdishit and mafkia and take away the rights of the socher. The other hand, if the socher is paying, whether it's month to month or at the end, then the maskir does have a right to be makdishit and impair the rights of the socher. In this instance, because of the fact that Hekdesh has this certain amount of strength to knock out even people who have shibudim, even people who have encumbrances or liens on a property, and since the maskir owns and he's makdishit, he can hurt the rights of the socher in that case where the socher did not prepay for it. That's how Tosafot reconciles these issues in the end. All right, next Mishnah. Chayavei arachin mimashkenim otan. People who are chayav to pay arachin, Beit Din will take collateral from them. That collateral is both to compel them to pay the arachin, and on the other hand, to pay for the arachin if they don't come up with the cash. They'll liquidate the item and use that as the in-lieu payment. Chayavei chatot vashamot. When it comes to korbanot of kapara, like chatat and asham, over there the Beit Din doesn't need to take a mashkon, because there we feel that the person has an impetus to bring it, even without the mashkon, the collateral being taken, because he wants kapara. The other hand, chayvei olot u'shlamim mimeshkenim otam. When it comes to olot and shlamim, there Beit Din does intervene and take collateral because people don't feel as compelled to bring those types of korbanot. And even though, as Rashi points out, that olah does provide kapara for mitzvot asay, for alav and itakli asay, nevertheless, it's not an obligatory korban. Never a person doesn't feel compelled to bring such korbanot, and that's why Beit Din might need to intervene and take collateral to ensure that the person performs on their obligation vis-a-vis the korbanot olah and korbanot shlamim. Now, the Gemara in Rosh Hashanah, when discussing this in the context of Baal Teh Acher, it says that a person, when they are chayav to bring a korban, they have three regalim in order to bring it before they're in violation of Baal Teh Acher. So the question is, what's the scenario in our mission over here? Where are they along the way, or along that continuum, in coming into the violation of Baal Teh Acher? So the Baal Teh Tosafot over there suggests that the case here is a case where the three regalim have not elapsed yet, but Beit Din is watching this person squander away his possessions or his wealth. And if he keeps up with this, if he stays on track with what he's doing now, he's not going to have the capacity to pay for his korban later on. Therefore, they can intervene in order to force him to bring the korban. That's with regards to Olah Shlamim. But with regards to Chatat and Asham, they won't intervene because there's this self-propelling reason why the person's going to bring it, because he wants to attain the kapara. On the other hand, the Ritva makes a suggestion that it is after the three regalim have passed and you're already in violation of Baal Teh Acher. That's when Beit Din intervenes and takes a mashkon to force you to bring the olah u'de shlamim, or to pay for it if you're not going to bring it, if you're not going to put up the money for it. And even though you're already in violation of Baal Teh Acher and you haven't brought it yet, so it seems like the person's not compelled by the fact that he wants kapara. Nevertheless, with regards to Chatat and Asham, we still will not take collateral from you, because we assume that kapara is a sufficient reason for a person to bring a korban, and they don't need any external stimuli in order to do that. And the Gemara says that even though taking a mashkon now is trying to forcibly have the person bring the korban, so that would maybe not make so much sense, because even though that the korban does not provide kapara until the person brings it willingly, here the term kapara is more loosely used. It doesn't literally mean kapara. This means discharging their obligation vis-a-vis the korban until they want to do it willingly. Shenemar lirtzono. The pasuk says that he does it of his own volition. Kofino to achimaratzeani. We compel him because we hit him. We give him a coat, malkino to achimaratzeani, until he says, I do want to do this. V'cheinata umer begite nashim. The same is true when it comes to giving a get. A get has to be given willingly by the husband. Kofino to achimaratzeani. So even though you need his willing acquiescence to it, nevertheless, Beit Din can intervene and cause him to will it, and cause him to want it, because they will give him a coat until he finally says, I want to do it. Now, even though a get mi'useh, a get that is given by force, or by compelling the individual to give the get, is pasul, nevertheless, this is not considered to be a get mi'useh. That's why the Rishonim have to figure out what's the difference between a get mi'useh and achimei rotzeani, when you beat him until he says rotzeani. So part of it might be the venue, which is, it has to be done in a Beit Din versus just by some vigilante individuals that are intervening. That might be one of the distinctions. The other distinction is how the Rambam formulates it over here, which is that a person in general wants to do the right thing in life and wants to abide by the mitzvot Torah and to do the will of Hashem. But sometimes there are things that get in the way. And those things that get in the way are external items that are preventing the person from doing what they really want to do. And so when Beit Din gives the person Malkot, they're just realigning their inner desire to do the right thing and their inner desire to follow the mitzvot Hashem with what they actually are going to do. So it's not that they are being forced or compelled to do something against their will, but rather they are being forced to recognize their deeper-seated will, which is that they want to perform the mitzvot and listen to Hashem and do what is right. That's how the way the Rambam explains this idea of Malkinoto. Others explain it that there are different ways to express something as being done willingly. It can be done willingly because the person wants to do it. It also can be done willingly even though the person doesn't necessarily identify with that which he's doing. He may not agree with it. He may not identify with it, but nevertheless, he knows it's the right thing to do, or he's doing what is expected of him. And that might be enough. Lirtzono, in these cases, may not be a deep-seated willingness and desire to do it in the sense that you agree and identify with it. That may not be the standard which is needed over here. The standard is that you just need to be doing it because it is the right thing to do. Even though you yourself may not want to do it or may not agree with it, nevertheless, you're doing it because you're being compelled to do the right thing. That might be enough. And that may be also the way to explain this. We'll get to this at the end of the perek, but this also has obviously major nafkaminot to the different methodologies and issues that come up with get mi'useh, a get being done by force, the intervention of secular courts, the intervention of secular law, and when is that classified or considered to be a mi'useh versus when is that considered to be proper pressure being placed on the individual to compel them to give a get in certain situations. So Amara Papa, Pamim Shechayve Chataot Mimashkaninutan. There are some times that even Chayve Chataot we take a mashkon for, and Chayve Olot in Mashkinutan. And by Olot we don't do it. I mean the opposite of what our Mishnah says. Chayve Chataot Mashkaninutan. Example of Chayve Chataot where we do take a mashkon is the Chatat Nazir. When it comes to the Chatat Nazir, which is the Kevan, Damarmar, Im Gileach Alachat Mishloshtan, Yatsa, Vim Nizrak Alav, Echad Men Adamim, Utar Nazir Lishtot Yain, Litameh Meitim. He can shave his hair at the end of the process on any one of the korbanot. Once that korban is brought, then the Nazir can drink wine and be Mitameh Meitim, meaning that his Nazirut is over. If a person is Migaleach, his hair, on any one of the three korbanot that are brought at the end of the Neder Nezirut, which are an Ola, a Chatat, and a Shlamim, that Chatat that's being brought at that point in time may not be necessary in order to terminate the Nezirut. Any one of the three Korbanot will help him to terminate the Nezirut, and therefore allow him to then drink wine and cut his hair and be Metameh L'Metim, and then he may not feel compelled to bring the remainder of the Korbanot. So if he brought one of the other two Korbanot besides the Chatat, then this person is not going to feel any impetus to bring the Chatat. And that's why we would compel him in this case to bring it or take a mashkon. For that reason, we intervene in the case of the Chatat there because the Chatat's not coming for Kapara. This might also be a more general machloket with regards to these types of Chataot. It's the Balei HaTosafot. In other places, call them Chataot HaMachshirin. They're not really Chataot of Kapara, and that is the Chatat HaNazir, the Chatat HaYoledet, and the Chatat of a Mitzora. All those which there are opinions in the Gemara that there were Chataim that force you to bring a Chatat. So, for instance, by the case of Nazir, there's the view of Rabbi Elazar HaKapar that a Nazir has to bring a Korban Chatat because he was Choteh al Chasach Atzmo min Hayayin, because he didn't drink wine during that period of time. And that was something that was incorrect or wrong, and he has to bring Kapara for that. So he views the Chatat Nazir as being a Chatat of Kapara, versus those that disagree and think that the Chatat is just a Makshir and not really for Kapara. So in that case, the Chatat may not just be a regular type of Chatat. It's a Chatat that is not needed necessarily here for the Akshara. It's also not a Chatat of Kapara. And that's why you would take a Mashkom. Pashaba velo maite. And therefore, he's going to be negligent about it and not bring it because he's already been released from his Neder Nezirut. Chayve olot ein mashkenim otan. What are examples of a chayve olat that they're not mashken? Ba'olat yoledet. That's the olav yoledet. Mainihu. What's the issue here? The akhtame kra. Because the pasuk says over there that you bring the olah first and then the chatat. In general, when you have an olah and a chatat, the chatat always goes first and then the olah goes second. And the psukim by yoledet makes it sound like the olah goes first and then the chatat. Therefore, in order for the woman to now be allowed to enter into the mikdash and eat kodoshim, she's going to have to bring the korbanot by yoledet. And the first of those korbanot is the olah. If the olah goes first and she's going to bring the chatat afterwards in order to attain that quote-unquote kapara, which there is a day as well, that the yoledet needs kapara because she takes the nether not to have other children because of the pain of childbirth. So then you can view it as a chatat, a real chatat, or if it's a chatat of hakshara, that is makshir the woman to eat kodoshim and to enter into the mikdash. Since the structure of the korbanot is olah and then a chatat, she's going to have to bring the Ola before she brings the Chatat. And so now we're going to not have to compel her to bring the Ola, because the only way for her to get to the Chatat is to bring the Ola, and the Chatat is what's makshir her or matir her or mechaper for her, and therefore the Ola doesn't need a mashkon because it's part of the process of kapara. Mar says, v'amar rova the mikra ag dima katuv, that the pasuk puts them in that order, but that's it. The pasuk says that the Ola goes for the Chatat, but in reality, that's not the way it is. That's just the way it's written in the psukim, but that's not the way that it's practiced, or the way that the Rabbeinu Gershom says is, that's the requirement that you bermakdish the Ola before the Chatat, the Mikra, to call them their names as korbanot. But that doesn't mean you have to bring them in that order. You might be able to bring the Chatat first. If that's the case, then that Ola would require a mashkon, because it's not absolutely necessary that the Ola come before the Chatat. Ela bolat mitzora. It's about the Ola of the mitzora. The Tanya, Rabbi Shmuel beno Rabbi Yehuda ben Brok Omer, Kishem shechatato vashamo ikavto. Just like the Chatat the Hashem or ma'akev the mitzora from attaining kapara, kacholoto akavto. So too, the Ola is also necessary, and without it, the mitzora does not become tahor. And that's why Tosafot back on Yud Zayin and Bet asked about the Mishnah that says when we're trying to determine the person's economic capacity to pay for the korbanot, over there with regards to mitzora, there were three different opinions as whether it was associated with the asham, the chatat, or the shtei tzipporim. And then the opinion that said it was associated with the asham is because the asham is the machshir. That's what allows him then to leave his position as a mitzora and re-enter society. But what Tosafot points out over there, based on our Gemara here, is that you need all three korbanot. Without the three korbanot, you can't be mukshar and leave the world of mitzora. So what's the Gemara saying over there that the asham is the makshir? So Tosafot in the end explains that, yes, all three korbanot are necessary to release the person from the din of tzarat and from being a mitzora. Nevertheless, the only korban that is sole purpose is the hakshara of the mitzora is the asham. The Chatat also has a din of kapara. It's also brought in other contexts in kapara. Ola as well has additional purposes besides being makshir, the individual. The asham has one purpose, and that's to be makshir, the mitzora. And therefore, the asham is distinguished from the others, even though all of them are part of the hakshara, as we see over here. And again, since you need all three korbanot in order to re-enter the kahal, so then you don't need to be memashkin, the ola, because just like the Chatat and the asham of the mitzora are for kapara and are going to be brought by the individual because he needs them or it's a prerequisite from gaining that tara. So too, the ola is in that same boat based on this mamra, and therefore you don't need to take a mashkon for that ola. Now Gemara says, Avo pik she'ein mitkaper lo ad she'itretze. Tan Rabbanan, yakrivoto, which is extraneous language because it says yakrivenu. So what's yakrivoto? Lamei she'kofinoto. From there you see that you can compel him, meaning that yakriv oto means that you make him be makriv, or you bring him closer to being makrivit. Yochol ba'al korcho, you would think that even against his will you could do such. Tamalomar, there's so no. It has to be done willingly. Haketzat, how do you resolve that? Kofin oto achemar rotzeani, you beat him until he says, I want to do it. So then, yes, you compelled him, but he compelled him in a way, or such a way that the person wants to do it. Amar Shmuel, Ola Tzrichadat. When it comes to an Ola, the person bringing the Korban has to be aware of the Korban. Shinemar Lirtzono, like we said over here. Micah Mashmalan, where it says, what is Shmuel teaching us that we don't know already? Tanina, we already learned that in our Mishnah. Afo pi she'en mitkaperlo ad she'itretze. Shinemar Lirtzono. Our Mishnah says that you're not mitkaper until the person acquiesces to that which he is bringing. Then what do you need to tell me? That the Ola Tzrichadat, that's obvious from our Mishnah, from the Braita that we brought, that you need the person's acquiescence with regards to the Ola. It says, look, Tzricha, the Parish Le Chavre, that his friend separated out the Korban on his behalf. He had to bring a Korban, and the friend did it for him, or separated out the Korban on his behalf. Maudetema, what I would have thought is, Ki be'inan dat midide. When do I need his acquiescence or his understanding? Is when he's bringing it from his own possession. When his friend's doing it, why do we care? Why do we need him to acquiesce to it? But it says, Kamash Malon, that's not true. The Zimnin, the Lo Nechale, the Chaper, Mide, the Lo Dide. Sometimes the owner does
does not want to attain kapara except through his own payment or through his own korban. He doesn't want someone else bringing the korban. He wants to attain the kapara through his own korban. That's the chiddush of Shmuel, that even in that scenario, you need the dat balim. You need the balim to acquiesce. Meitave, is that really true? Chatatove, shemo, shoploni, alai. The person says, I'm going to take care of the chatat and asham of that individual's chayav, a chatat or asham. Ledat yatsa. If the individual knows about it and is made aware of it, then yatsa. Then he discharges his obligation with the person who brings the korban on his behalf. Shalol ledat. But if he does not aware of it, doesn't know about it, lo yatsa. Olato vishlamav, shoploni, alai. If the person says, I'm going to step up and pay for or take care of the olah shlamim of such and such a person, I'm responsible for it. Ben ladat, ben shalo ladat yatsa. Whether the person is aware of it or acquiesces to it, doesn't really matter. You're yotze in that situation. So that seems to be going against what Shmuel said. Shmuel said that olah requires dat. That's even when someone else is bringing it on your behalf. Yet over here, the Braita says that that's true by a chatat and asham. That's not true by an ola and shlamim. So how do we reconcile Shmuel with the Braita? Amalecha Shmuel. Ketanya hi, that Braita is speaking about bishat kapara. That's talking about the time of atonement. Dirtze bishat afrasha. Because the person already gave permission or acquiesced at the time of afrasha. Kikamina ano. What I was speaking about, what Shmuel says, is bishat afrasha. At the time that you're separating out the animal, you're being makdish the animal. So according to Shmuel, when it comes to shat hafrasha, the time that you're segregating or designating the animal to be used in the korban, they are both for chatat anasham and an olah v'shlamim. In both of those instances, we're going to require that you have dat at the shat hafrasha. When it comes to the shat kapara, at that point, the bright dog kicks in and says that by an olah v'shlamim, we don't need the acquiescence, because the acquiescence was already gained at the time of hafrasha, when they were separated out or segregated out. Since you already got permission by the time of the hafrasha, you don't need to get permission by the point of quote-unquote kapara, or the bringing of the olah shlamim, and that'll be good even without a reassessment of the acquiescence of the individual. And the Rambam goes as far as to say that even if the person now objects at the time of kapara, we ignore it because we already got that acquiescence at the time of hafrasha. Other Rishonim just say that that's the default situation. But if the person comes back at the shat kapara and says, I don't want to give permission, then that undermines what he said at the time of the hafrasha. Whereas by chatat and asham, we're going to require acquiescence both at the time of hafrasha as well as the time of kapara. And that's because, again, we saw that even if a person agrees up front by the time of hafrasha, the time of kapara, we also want acquiescence. So that'd be the way Shmuel explains it. Pliga de ula. This argues on ula. Dama ula. Lo chilku ben chatat de ula, ela shechatat tzricha dat, bishat afrasha. They didn't distinguish between a chatat and ula, except for the fact that a chatat, at the time it's being segregated out, requires dat. Vola ain't tzricha dat. On the other hand, an ula does not require dat at the time of hafrasha. Bishat afrasha. That's true. Aval b'shat kapara, idi v'idi ledat yatzash lo ledat lo yatza. That's true at the time of afrasha, that you can segregate or separate between the dinim and olah and shlamim, where you do not need his acquiescence, versus the chatat v'asham, where you do need his acquiescence. But once it comes to kapara, everybody agrees you need the acquiescence of the individual in that case. Meitavei, what about the braita? Chatato v'ashamo olato v'shlamav shoploni alai. Person accepts to bring these korbanot on behalf of an individual, ladat yatsa. If he has the acquiescence of the individual, it works. Shalo ladat lo yatsa. If he doesn't have the dat, then it doesn't work. So this braita seems to indicate you need it across the board. Shmuel mukila b'shat hafrasha. Shmuel says that's just fine. That's at the time of hafrasha. When you read mafrish it, then you need permission with regards to all the korbanot. But when it comes to kapara, that's where we saw the previous braita distinguish between olah shlamim and chatat v'asham. Ula mukila b'shat kapara. Ula says this bright that says they all need that. That's talking about at the moment of kapara. Amara papa matnaita hadodi lokashion. The brightot are not a stira for each other. Habashat kapara, habashat hafrasha. One of them is speaking about the time of kapara. One of them is speaking about the time of hafrasha. So they're not necessarily mutually exclusive. They're just speaking about different incidents. V'amurai nami lokasho. And for the amuraim, it's also not problematic. Shmukel mukila kamaita b'shat kapara, batraita b'shat hafrasha. He'll say the first braita that we brought before
was at the time of Kapara. At the time of Kapara, you need acquiescence with regards to Katata Nasham, not with regards to Ola and Shlamim. Versus the Batraita, the latter Braita, which you just brought, Bashat Afrasha, was at the time of Afrasha, where you need acquiescence across the board. Ula Amuki Ipcha, and Ula will set them up just the opposite. He'll say the first Braita is speaking about Shab Kapara, the first Braita is talking about by the time of Afrasha, where there you only need the acquiescence with regards to Ola Shlamim. And the latter Braita that says you need it across the board, that's Bishat Kapara. Amorai, Vaidai Plige. But the Amoraim, Ula and Shmuel, clearly argue. Where it says, Pshita, that's pretty straightforward. You can separate between the Braita and put them in different cases, and you can explain each of the two Braita according to each of the two Amoraim, but it's clear that the Amoraim disagree with each other. One says that you need acquiescence by Hafrasha across the board, and that's Shmuel. And Ula says that you don't. You need acquiescence across the board, right? Only at the time of Kapara. So they clearly argue. Gemara says, no, Ma'adutema, Ma'ay B'shat HaFrasha, the Kamar Shmuel. When Shmuel says that you need acquiescence at the time of HaFrasha, means Af B'shat HaFrasha. Not only at the time of HaFrasha, but also at the time of HaFrasha, and even at the time of Kapara. You need acquiescence in both cases. Ba'afa Gavdach Kamaita to Yuvtei, but then, of course, the first Braita would be problematic for Shmuel. If he says that you need acquiescence both by Shat Kapara and Shat Afrasha, and there's no distinction between Ola Shlamim and Chatat Vasham, then how do you explain the first Braita, which does make a distinction between them? That Gemara says, okay, even though that would be problematic, still maybe Shmuel held that way. If he held that way, then maybe he could agree with Ula, because at least with regards to Kapara, they both agree that you need acquiescence across the board. Mashalom, we don't say that. And that Shmuel's position when he says that by Shat HaFrasha, that I require both the Ola and the Chatat to have acquiescence or permission, that is Dafka by Shat HaFrasha, but not by Shat Kapara. And that's why we have a Machloket Amoraim over here. The Balei HaTosafot explain what they think is the Shoresh, a Machloket between Shmuel and Ula over here. And that is, where do we place the emphasis? Ula places the emphasis on the kapara aspect of it, which is the smicha, which is the placement of the malim's hands on the animal to perform the smicha. And they want to perform the smicha, whether it's a case where the individual is bringing a chatat v'asham and he's doing vidui, versus an olah shlamim where he's doing the kapara, and he doesn't want to gain that kapara, even though there's no real kapara over here, simply smicha. But he still wants to perform that on the animals. And therefore, you need acquiescence in both of those cases. Versus the Shat HaFrasha, whereby the only real problem we have is that a person doesn't want to gain kapara from his friend's money. That's applicable by a Chatat V'Asham. That's not applicable by an Ola. And that's the reasoning behind Ula's position. On the other hand, Shmuel says that the real issue is at Shat HaFrasha. At the time of HaFrasha, we want to know whether the person's okay with another individual providing that kapara for him. If they already acquiesce at that point in time, then if you move on to the Ola Shlamim, we say that the default is that if he gave permission before, then all likelihood he gave permission now as well. Versus the case of the Chatat V'Asham, even though he gave permission before, when it comes to the actual doing of the vidui and the kapara that's associated with the smicha on the animal, that the individual wants to do himself because that smicha provides kapara and is integral to the kaparata korban. That's why he won't give that up, and that's why you need to seek permission even at the point of kapara. As opposed to the Ola Shlamim, even though they require smicha, that smicha is not integrally connected to the kapara or to the processing of the animal, and therefore the individual, if he already gave permission before, would continue, we assume, would continue to get permission even b'shat kapara. And that's how Balei HaTosafot explained this machloket between Ula and Shmuel. Now the Gemara moves on to the get issue. V'chein b'gitei nashim. Similarly, by gitei nashim kofin, we do the same thing. We have compelled the individual to do the get, even though a get me'useh is pasul. Nevertheless, we compel the individual at shomer rotzani until he acquiesces. Amar Rav Sheshet, hai man demaser moda'a, gita modei moda. Person who creates a disclaimer before he gives a get, that disclaimer is effective. He goes to a dame and says to them, I want you to know that if I give a get at any point now, it's because I'm being forced to give a get. And so now, from the outset, I am writing a disclaimer that any get that comes from me is clearly a forced get because I would never willingly give a get. That type of disclaimer would ruin any get that this individual gave. So now what Rav Sheshet is pointing out is that a moda'ah works by gitin. So Gemara says, Pshita, that's pretty straightforward. Why shouldn't it work? Gemara says, Lo tzricha dasu v'irtze. That's a case where Beit Din compelled him to agree to give a get. So mal detema, I would have thought, bitule batle. When he says already, I'm going to give the get, because he was compelled to do it by Beit Din, and then he finally acquiesces to give it, we would assume that not only does he give it willingly, but he also nullifies any disclaimers that he gave beforehand. So kamash malan, that we don't say that. That's the chiddush of Rav Sheshet, that we don't say just because he agreed to give the get, means that he was nullifying all disclaimers that he gave before. Dim kain, because if that was the case, litnei, then the Mishnah should have written, achiitain, until he gives the get. Meaning once he gives the get, then that says by definition he's nullified any disclaimer besides that. So my achiomar rotze ani. Why does our Mishnah have to say that he has to give the get, but rather he has to say that I acquiesce and I want to give it? Adem evatale the modiei, until he nullifies or disclaims all of his disclaimers. That's what it means rotze ani. Rotze ani is not simply that he agrees to give the get. It also means that he nullifies or basically says that anything I've said until this point in time and after this point in time is not relevant. Like many contracts that include a paragraph that says that any oral agreements or anything that was agreed to before this is nullified or overturned or superseded by this contract. And that's what we're saying here too. When he says Rotsani by the Kitin, that means that he's saying this supersedes anything I've said before. And that's what we're trying to get to over here. And Tosfot says, Vigach nagu olam levatel ko modei umodei da'atu migo modei b'shat tivata get u'b'shat netina. Time the person writes the get, and the time they give the get, we make them disclaim any disclaimers with regards to the get. Because shinan shema beteloto. Because otherwise we have the fear that he could have nullified the get by creating this disclaimer before giving the get. In order to ensure that a get is given and the get is a real get, we force the individual at the time of the writing the get and at the giving of the get to disclaim any disclaimer and basically say that whatever he's doing now is the final word with regards to the get, and there's no undermining of this get. And I sent out a large number of mikorot dealing with this issue in the modern halacha and the nafkaminot that come out of what we just learned today with regards to a get meuseh. All right, with that we end the fifth parak, Hadron Halach, Homer Mishkali. And now we begin the sixth parak, Shuma Yitomim, Shloshim Yom. It comes to selling off property that's been taken by Beit Din to compensate, whether it's creditors or a shah because of a ketubah, the Yitomim are obligated to pay this money, so we need to liquidate some of their assets. So when Beit Din goes in to liquidate their assets, the auction has to last a minimum of 30 days. Shuma Hekdesh, and if a person is Makdish, a stay mikna, or a piece of property, and then the Gizbar has to sell it off in order to monetize it, there, Shishim Yom, it's 60 days. Now, the Tosafot over here says, what's so special about Yitomim? Beit Din intervenes in many cases to foreclose on property in order to pay back a creditor or to take care of a ketubat isha. So why is it unique to the Yitomim over here when you have other instances where this could come up or be plausible? So Tosafot says, Eino Hanami. Anytime it comes to Beit Din selling off, monetizing property on behalf of an individual, their capacity as a Beit Din, they have to auction it off for 30 days. So why Yitomim are mentioned here is because that's a chiddush. You would have thought that by Yitomim, you'd have to wait 60 days like Hekdesh. Because many places, Yitomim or youngsters that are minors are given the same rights as Hekdesh. If that's the case, then maybe we'd also have to auction off for 60 days for Yitomim, just like we do that for Hekdesh. And that's what the Mishnah is coming to dispel and say, even Yotomim are only 30 days. Umachazim babokir ube'erev. And that announcement about the auction is done every morning and every evening. Where it says, Mishnah babokir ube'erev. Why do they make the announcement about the auction every morning and every evening? Amar Yehuda Marav, b'shat hotzat hapolim u'b'shat haknasat hapolim. The time that the polim go out and the time the polim come in. B'shat hotzat hapolim, when the polim are going out, De'ika de'nechel mizban. There are sometimes people or balabatim that are looking to buy a property. Amalulu po'alim, he'll say to the workers, Izilu sayrele ni'ale. Go take a look at the property on my behalf. Tell me if it's a good quality. Tell me what you think of the property. Shadach nasat po'alim, when the po'alim are coming in, de'nidkar. Damalulu, he remembers that he asked them to look at it. Nezel nishalune. Think, hear what they say. Let me get the feedback from them. So now the simple way to read this is that Bishat Hotzat Polim is when the Polim go out to work for the day. And Bishad Taknasat Polim is when they come back home in the evening. And that actually would match what the Mishnah says, which is Boker and Erev, in the morning and in the evening. So in the morning is when they're going out to work, and the evening is when they're coming back from work. Tosafot does not love that explanation, because he says, why would they balabite when they're going out to work? Why would he be speaking to them about this information? Doesn't make so much sense. So the Baal Tosafot suggests that it's just the opposite. It says over here, Bishat Otsata Polim. Otsata Polim is when they are coming back from work. They finish their day. On their way back from finishing their day of work, that's when the Baal HaBayit asks them, why don't you on your way home take a look at the property? So that's not on his time. It's not on his clock. He just asks them a favor to look at it on the way out. And then the next morning, the Po'alim come to work. He'll be reminded when they announce it in the morning to ask them what they saw when they were walking home last night after he had dismissed them after they had left work. So that's the way the Baal HaTosafot explain it, because they think it makes more sense in that order. Even though then the Hotzat Polim and Achnasat Polim is just the opposite of Boker and Erev. The Hotzat Polim is at night, and the Achnasat Polim is in the morning. We have a brayta that supports this. Shuma Yitomim, 30 Yom. It comes to the assessment of the Yitomim's property for sale in an auction. We do that for 30 days. Shuma Ekdei, 60 Yom. And for Ekdei, it's 60 days. Machrizim Boker Ba'erev. You announce it, the auction, day and night, morning and evening. Bishat Otsat Polim, Ubishat Achnasat Polim. Both when the Polim are either going out to work or coming back from work, then we make such an announcement. Omer, and the announcement that's made is, Sde Ploni Bisimanea Ubimitzreha. It gives you the basic information about the field, both about the boundaries of the field, as well as unique features of the field. Kachi Yafa, this is its production. This is its productive capability. Kachi Shuma, and this is the value that Beit Din came up for the piece of land. Kol Erotzei Likach, Yavo V'Yikach. For anybody who wants to purchase it, should come and purchase it. V'almanat Liten Lisha B'Tubata, Ulevalchov B'Chovov. And you give them the information as to why the property is being sold. Is it being sold to repay a creditor? Or is it being sold to pay a woman for her ktuba? So Gemara says, why do you have to announce what the purpose of the monies is? You're just trying to monetize the field. Why does it matter who the money's going to or what the purpose of the liquidation or monetization is? Where it says, because some people want the property to be liquidated for a creditor to make il bizuze. He's not so makpid on the currency that he gets back. Meaning that if he has the ability to get paid, that's all he cares about. The creditor wants to make sure he doesn't lose his money. And so he's just happy to get back the currency and the coinage that was used. But he's not looking for perfection in the coins. He's not going to worry about a little nick here, a little bit missing here. He's not going to be so makpid. So the person might be more compelled to deal with the individual because they know that these monies are going to a creditor. It's not going to be so makbid on the coinage that's being used, the shape of the coinage, the age of the coinage, other problems that might come up with that currency. V'ika d'nechle b'isha, some people want it to be k'tubat isha, the shakle al yad, because she's willing to take it in an installment plan. She doesn't necessarily need all the money now. She's willing to accept it in a payment or installment plan, by which the person then can pay it over time rather than have to paying for it all up front. So therefore, the knowledge about why this property is being liquidated is helpful because it might attract different bidders for different reasons. And that's why we announce exactly who is the beneficiary of the liquidation over here, because that might compel different buyers to come in and buy. Now, what's interesting here about the case is that there's a Shumat Beit Din. There's an assessment by Beit Din as to what the true price of the field is. Well, Beit Din already assigned the true price. What do you need an auction for? And then, what happens if the auction results differ from that of the Shuma? The Baal HaTosafot say, interesting over here, if the Baal Chov, if the creditor over here is willing to accept the property at the price that Beit Din assesses it, then it's game over. You don't need to have an auction at all. If he accepts to take the land in lieu of payment, and the land is worth whatever Beit Din said it's worth, then that's the end of the case, and we move on. Other Rishonim believe that you need to have the auction, even with the Shum Beit Din, because you want to ensure, or you're basically checking the market price and making sure that they're not underestimating or there's a problem with the estimation. Therefore, they go to the market to corroborate the price that they came up with. In addition, when the auction goes through, if the auction exceeds the assessment of Beit Din, there's not really a problem,
because then whoever's the highest bidder gets the property. The problem comes up in a case where the bidders come in below the Shuma Beit Din. What do we do in that case? So the tour says you basically hand the property to the creditor, and he gets the property at the assigned value of Beit Din. So even though they were not able to corroborate it in the market, nevertheless, that was the assessment of Beit Din, and therefore we compel the individual to take it in order to get paid back at the Shuma Beit Din, even though the market price didn't reach up to the levels of the Shuma of Beit Din. And so that's how we deal with these situations. All right, we're going to stop here by the bottom of Chaf Aleph Amud Bet.